This hour on Inside Islam.
May I ask the learned ones a question?
Proceed.
O wise men, what is bread?
Bread, stupid quip. Bread is a substance which is for the purpose of nourishing people.
Bread is a compound.
It is a gift from God.
It has to be admitted that nobody really knows.
Your Majesty, is it not strange that they cannot agree on the nature of something they eat every day, yet are unanimous that I am a heretic?
That's a long-lost excerpt from Canadian animator Richard Williams' self-described masterpiece, a 1960s film based on the life of 13th century Sufi mystic Mullah Nasruddin. In that scene, Nasruddin is accused of heresy, but is able to trick the king and his council of wise men with a simple question about bread. Richard Williams was obsessed with the wise fool of Islamic folklore and worked for 26 years on his project, only to see it released in the 1990s under a different title and missing his beloved Mullah. But it's easy to explain his obsession. Tales of Mullah Nasruddin have taken on a transcultural life of their own ever since their obscure origins in 13th century Turkey, showing up in novels, films, cartoons, and even on YouTube. My guest this hour, Jamal Rahman, uses stories from the Mullah to begin his sermons. Welcome to Inside Islam on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jean Faraca. This hour, Mullah Nasruddin, Islam's Holy Fool. Have you ever heard of Mullah Nasruddin? What do you know about Sufism in Islam? Does it surprise you to learn that there is a long-standing, centuries-old tradition of teaching through humor in Islam? Can Sufism work as an antidote to militant Islam, do you think? And what body of proverbial wisdom or folklore have you learned from? To join the conversation, call 1-877-GLOBE-07, 1-877-456-2307. Send an email to hereonearth@wpr.org. You'll find us under Here on Earth Show on Facebook or Twitter. Or you can leave a comment on our Inside Islam website. That's www.insideislam.wisc, that stands for Wisconsin.edu. Joining us from the KUOW studios in Seattle is Sheikh Jamal Rahman, who is a Muslim Sufi minister originally from Bangladesh, who is co-founder of a mixed-faith congregation in Seattle called the Interfaith Community Church. He's also one of the three so-called interfaith amigos and the author of several books, including The Fragrance of Faith, The Enlightened Heart of Islam. Jamal, welcome back. It's wonderful to have you with us again.
Thank you so much, Jean. I'm delighted to be back.
And we're delighted to have you. This is great stuff. I mean, as you well know, Islam is very burdened, I think, by an excessively heavy image. I think of the Taliban, who forbade the people of Afghanistan to laugh when they were in power in that country. And yes. I think that made a lasting impression on a lot of us.
True, and that's really, in a sense, of course, very tragic, but also very, very funny, because, in fact, the Quran tells us that it's a gift. There's a verse in the Quran which says that it is God who has given you tears and laughter. So in that sense, to laugh is sacred, actually. It's a gift from God, just as we allow ourselves to cry also. These tears are also sacred.
You learned about Mullah Nasruddin from your mother.
That's right, yes. And in fact, in our part of the world, in the Muslim world, many, many children, I would say most children, are very familiar with stories of the mullah. And rather than sermonize or give children large tracts of prose to read, they just, at the right time, tell the appropriate mullah story to have an impact.
And do you have a favorite mullah story? Can you remember the first story,
yes,
perhaps, that your mother ever told?
You know, this is the month of Ramadan, and in the month of Ramadan, the major thrust, the spiritual practice is, among other things, is the practice of gratitude. So I remember this story about the mullah who has lost his donkey. And that's a very big deal in that part of the world. And so the entire village tries to find the donkey, and they cannot find the donkey. They come back in the evening to give mullah the bad news. And where is the mullah? He's in the town square, on his knees, saying, "Allah, thank you so much. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful." So the townsfolk say, "Mullah, maybe you haven't heard the bad news. Your donkey is lost forever." He says, I know, but I'm so grateful. Imagine what could have happened to me if I was on the donkey." So it's a funny story, but there are many levels of meaning. And this is what I think the subtle teachers are trying to express. Yes, of course, be grateful in good times, but can you also be grateful in times of difficulties? Because if in times of difficulties you're grateful, then we are giving thanks for unknown blessings already on their way. I remember this story very clearly, very distinctly, and very fully.
And, you know, the beauty of this is that it is in its simplicity. Obviously, this is a story that could easily be told to children. But then,
yes,
take us a little bit deeper. Take us into a different level of understanding of the story.
For example, in my situation, as it with many others, these stories are told in tandem with maybe a Quranic verse or a hadith, which is a saying of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. For example, when my mother told me this story, she also told me the story of what Prophet Muhammad would say. The Prophet Muhammad taught that, "Have you ever watched a bird as it sips water? Immediately after sipping water, it tilts its neck backwards, of course for the water to flow, but really for praise to flow heavenward." So gratitude, the key point here is, can you make gratitude a very integral part of your everyday practice in life? And how can you do that? And if you do that, you will know that no matter what, you will be happy. You know, Gene, I just want to add one thing here, very important. I'm from Bangladesh, as you had mentioned, and there was a report from the University of Oxford and Cambridge about 10 years ago, going all over the world trying to find out where are people the happiest, the most content.
I remember
that.
They chose Bangladesh.
And one reason they gave was, the people have learned the art of being grateful.
Huh.
And in the process of learning to be grateful in good times, as also in times of difficulties, they have really mastered a key spiritual practice, you might say a key to happiness in life.
And how does Sufism relate to this in particular? You mentioned that part of the world, which is the most populous in terms of adherence of Islam, Sufism prevails.
Yes, actually, there's a big misunderstanding about Sufism. Even some Muslims are not very familiar. Most people think that Sufism is a sect or denomination of Islam. So, for example, some people will say, "Oh, Jamal, you're a nice guy, you're a Muslim, but you're actually a Sufi. You're not really a Muslim." But that is not true. You see, there are two main denominations in Islam, meaning just like Christians have Catholics and Protestants, in Islam we have Sunni and Shia. And a Sufi is either a Sunni or a Shia, but a Sufi is simply one who believes in practicing primarily the spirit of the tradition. If I can give a metaphor of the glass and water, we are so busy cleaning the outside of the glass, so attached to the institution of the religion, a Sufi, who can be a Sunni or a Shia, says, "What about the water, the spirit, the essence, the substance of the tradition?" So a Sufi is simply a Muslim who can be a Shia or a Sunni, but who aspires to live the tradition. And they have actually, in that sense, become a whole body, a movement within Islam. And they're the ones who are primarily responsible for the spread of Islam all over the world.
And is that because happiness is contagious?
Yes, happiness. And, you know, they say if you focus on the essence of the tradition and they make it interesting, because we don't want to be drawn back into the essence because, you know, it is inconvenient. I mean, my Christian pastor friend Don McKenzie, who met on the radio, like he would say, love your enemy. It's simple, but it's very, very, very inconvenient. The Sufis have a way of making that very functional in one's everyday life through stories, through poetry, and through self-examination, through spiritual practices. So Sufism is very popular in all Muslim countries.
But Sufis are looked down upon by some Muslims.
Yes.
Haven't you been persecuted throughout history?
No, that's actually a misconception. The reason why people think they are mistreated or they are oppressed, they look down upon, is because the only countries we are hearing news from is in the Middle East, especially Saudi Arabia, for example. That's one country which is very hard on Sufis. And people equate that with Islam everywhere in the world. Saudi Arabia is the most conservative Muslim countries. And there, it is difficult to practice Sufism. But if you take, for example, South Asia, Southeast Asia, and if you combine South and Southeast Asia, that's over 60% of Muslims. Sufism is really a movement which is inherent and integral to the everyday life of the common person. And that is why when the Taliban, they have begun to desecrate the shrines of Sufis, the common person, in Pakistan, in South Asia, in Southeast Asia, other places, they are really getting incensed.
So, in a way, the Taliban represent one extreme and Sufis represent another.
That's right. Sufism, I would say, represents the heart of Islam. And like, for example, the Wahhabis would say, it is these Sufis who made our heart so soft that we have really plummeted from a position of what they consider primacy when Islam was a predominant religion for 1,000 years. And the last 200, 300 years, it's sunk to the lowest of the lowest because of the decline of political and economic resources. And those people, they blame the Sufis, meaning they have made the Muslims' heart soft. Therefore, this has led to a decline.
We're talking this hour with Jamal Rahman. He is the author, most recently, of The Fragrance of Faith, The Enlightened Heart of Islam. In that wonderful book, he uses the stories of Mullah Nasruddin to tell teachings, to explore teachings from Islam. And we'll hear more of them throughout the hour, this hour, Inside Islam, on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. I'm Jean Faraca. What about you? Have you ever heard of Mullah Nasruddin? Does it surprise you that Islam has this centuries-old tradition of teaching through humor? Do you read Rumi? Is there any way in which Sufism, with its softening heart, can actually work as an antidote to militant Islam? And tell us about your own sources of folk wisdom or fables and what you use in teaching values to your children. 1-877-GLOBE-07. 1-877-456-2307. Our email address is hereonearth@wpr.org. You'll find us under Here on Earth Show on Facebook or Twitter. Tintin, one of the most popular comic characters around the globe, has taken his readers from China to America to the moon and back. Yet Tintin and his Belgian creator have been accused of racism and sexism. How has Tintin survived? I'm Jean Faraca. Join us Thursday at 3 here on Earth.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Madison Gas and Electric, working to meet the growing energy needs of our community through a mix of resources, while helping customers protect the environment through conservation. Energy topics are available at mge.com.
Here on Earth is making it easier than ever to share our content. Go to hereonearth.org, find your favorite program in our archive, and click on Share. You can post links to the show on your blog, Facebook, Twitter, send a link by email, and more. Plus, you can download recent programs for free on MP3. Share your favorite shows today at hereonearth.org.
There was this time when he was going somewhere with a friend, and suddenly he bumped into another man, and that man said, "Hi, Mulan, how are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm fine, thank you." "And how is your wife?" "She's also fine, thank you very much." "And how are your children?" "Oh, they're also doing well, thank you very much." And then he left. This friend was surprised. "You know, Mulan Asruddin, I've known you since many years. You are not married." Mulan Asruddin said, "You know, yes, I know. But why to have an argument?"
That's one of the Mulla Nasruddin stories that we found on YouTube, told in this case by world musician Manish Vyas at a concert last year, sharing his favorite Nasruddin story. We're talking about the tradition of teaching Islam through humor this hour. My guest is Jamal Rahman, a Muslim Sufi minister, one of the three interfaith amigos, and the author of The Fragrance of Faith, The Enlightened Heart of Islam. Jamal Rahman, why is Mulla Nasruddin so popular? What is it about this guy that he's survived so many centuries and shows up in so many places?
I think that's because the soul, it is said, responds either with tears or laughter. So laughter really is a very divine quality of the soul. And a lot of Sufis explain that actually the more you become aware, as Prophet Muhammad said, when you move from a knowledge of the tongue to a knowledge of the heart, you have no choice because it comes naturally, it boils up from within you, you begin to laugh. It is natural when you have higher awareness. I'll give an example. Rumi paraphrases a saying of the Prophet Muhammad. He said, "You know, here we are so scared that we shall dissolve into non-existence. We shall die." He said, "If you really knew the truth, non-existence is trembling in fear that it might be given human shape." So when you know that, you have no choice but to really have that, either that outer smile, you laugh, or you have that inner smile. And that inner smile is about things are not as they seem to be. It's part of a larger, more mysterious story. Mm. And the more aware, the more alive I am, the more I begin to laugh naturally.
You know, I've heard that the Quran also operates in a similar way, in that the stories are told over and over, the same stories, but from different perspectives. And yes, that the idea is as you mature and grow, presumably in wisdom and understanding, you can derive deeper and deeper meanings from these same stories.
Absolutely true. It goes not only with stories, with verses of any holy book. For example, the verse, "Every so where you turn is the face of Allah." And there are mullah stories that go with that. For example, is the mullah story which says, mullah was visiting the grand mosque in Mecca. And Muslims, when they pray, they point towards the Kaaba, which symbolizes the house of God. It's draped in black. And he was sleeping in the grand mosque with his feet facing towards the Kaaba, which is symbolically the house of God. And this angered the Meccans, who said, "How dare you point your feet towards the Kaaba?" In our culture, that's considered an insult. So he said, yes, "You're right, O Meccans. I tell you what, please pick up my feet and point it in the direction where Allah is not." And they all left him alone, you see. "Every so where you turn is the face of Allah." So as you meditate on that verse and that story, you begin to have a deeper and deeper and deeper understanding of that verse. So for example, my parents said, "Do you understand that?" And finally I got to the point where, wow, does that mean the devil is also the face of God? And as far as the Sufis are concerned, yes, it is the voice of God. And there are deeper explanations that I'd be happy to explain that if you want me to.
I think you can't just leave that out there.
Good. Okay. So, for example, so my parents told me, look at this verse in the Quran. The verse in the Quran says that the devil, Shaitan, as he's called, says, "Oh God, by your glory, by your power, I shall waylay humanity." So the understanding is, and Rumi explains this, that yes, the devil is also the face of Allah, but Allah does not approve of the devil. So what does that mean? Well, Rumi says, for example, a doctor, a medical doctor, needs for people to become ill for the doctor's livelihood. But does this mean that the doctor approves of the people suffering? No. Similarly, a baker needs people to be hungry. But does this mean the baker approves of people starving? No. That's a great mystery, which we understand, we intuit, we embrace more as we go deeper with these stories and verses.
Well, I once heard you say that whatever we think God is, the opposite is also true. And I thought about that. And I thought, well, we're told that God is all good. The opposite of that is to say that God is all evil. How can you say that?
Well, you know, there's a verse in the Quran which says, of everything we have created, we have also created opposites. So you may know that only God is one. That's because the limitations of human faculties we understand through duality. And that is why God appears to be angry. God appears to be very harsh. But that really is actually a learning for us. That is how we appreciate that which is not harsh, that which is not severe. You know, honey is sweet in contrast to vinegar. The mystics say God turns you from one feeling to another so you may have two wings to fly, not one. And when one has a higher understanding, one is able to embrace both.
Well, going back to the story of Mullah Nasruddin with his feet turned towards the Kaaba, would he be able to get away with that these days? I mean, if he really did that.
Yes.
If he was on Hajj and he was in Mecca and he slept with his feet facing the Kaaba, wouldn't he be punished?
You know, you're right. For example, I've been to Mecca many times because my parents were posted in Jeddah in those days, 1960s. And I've been there at least 52, 53 times. And yes, the culture is harsh there. For example, you have these big, tall, burly men who go around looking for women who are not dressed appropriately. And they admonish them. But is this a part of Islam? It's really a cultural aspect of that Islam in that particular society. So yes, culturally, they would do that, but that really is a poor reflection on the essence of the tradition.
But what is your explanation for why this tradition of teaching through humor and being more flexible, you know, in debating and seeking for explanations, for understandings. Why did that disappear? Why do we have so much trouble finding it alive, as an alive tradition in Islam these days?
You know, I think as a Pew Research, just I think a year ago, it conducted the largest research in Muslim countries, I think 30-some countries, 90% of Muslims, and they came back with the conclusion, a very definite conclusion, that the militancy, which you're talking, referring to so rightly, the militancy in Islam, they concluded, is not based on Islamic principles, but on political radicalization. And it is the politics, it is the difficulty of the politics of these centuries of colonialism, corporationism, then oppression now today by the Muslim governments oppressing their own people, that has really created a sense of helplessness, hopelessness, anger. There's a verse in the Quran which says, when there is chronic anger, hopelessness, helplessness, bitterness, hate, oppression, then it's not that the eyes become blind, the hearts become blind. And when the hearts become blind, that becomes a very difficult situation. How do you open hearts? You can use force, it clenches the hearts even more. You can use reason, it has limitations. Only that which comes from the heart can open another heart. And this is where the Mulla Nasruddin stories come in. That's where the verses come in, the mystics come in, to suggest ways of how you can really open up those hearts. And laughter is one of them.
We're at 1-877-GLOBE-07. We're talking with Jamal Rahman about the centuries-old tradition of teaching Islam through humor, and especially through the tales of Mulla Nasruddin. 1-877-456-2307. We have Jim joining us from Monona. Hi, Jim. Jim?
Thank you. I wonder if your guest could comment on humor in the face of extreme violence, especially the kind of weaponry and terrorism that our states impose on so-called our enemies. I know many people interpret Jesus as saying you have to learn to love your enemy, but that's denied as being consistent with any kind of citizenship. So how would you laugh at, you know, the weapons industry and the organization that teaches young people to train to kill the unknown enemy? Could you comment, please?
Yes, of course, these are very serious matters. But we have to realize that there's a distinction between behavior and being. Let's forego humor right now. Let's just talk about sacredness. A person's behavior can be very, very, very evil, but a person's being is never evil. And it's important to always keep that distinction in mind and know that there is sacredness even in a person who commits the worst violence. That is a reflection of that person's behavior. So if you keep that distinction in mind, it creates not a sense of humor, a sense of paradoxical amazement and bewilderment, which eventually leads to an inner smile that knows that in spite of all that is happening, there is sacredness in that situation.
Mm. Your book, The Fragrance of Faith, is chock full of Mulla Nasruddin's stories. And many of them I found really delightful. And also, they reminded me of other jokes I've heard. For example, the one in this that begins the chapter on the inner teacher.
Yes.
It goes like this. The mullah was deathly ill, lying on his bed, his life ebbing away, surrounded by family, friends, and his wailing wife. The doctor examined the mullah at length, turned to the mullah's wife, and spoke with eloquence. The Quran says, only Allah, the light of the heavens and earth, is immortal. O honorable wife of the mullah is no more. He is dead. As the doctor continued, the mullah was feebly heard to say, no, wait, I am alive. I am alive. Quiet, quiet, retorted his wife. The doctor is speaking. Don't argue with the doctor.
This is a great comment by the mullah, who really takes each one of us to task for being so codependent on authorities and experts and pundits. And, you know, we Muslims are very guilty of that. The Prophet made it very clear. The Prophet Muhammad said, even if the religious judge advises you about worldly matters, earthly matters, first consult your heart. But we have given over our power, our understanding, to experts and pundits. You know, there's a beautiful Eastern saying, when you hear a bird in song, do you have a need at that time to ask it for its credentials? We don't. But we have that conditioning, and we don't understand that deep within us are divine, amazing resources that is available.
So this story really illustrates over-reliance on external authority.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely, yes.
Our society is full of that. I mean, we turn to talking heads all the time. We hear from pundits.
Yes.
We hear from, well, we turn to government officials thinking that they're going to give us wisdom. And we forget that we have our own internal authority.
Absolutely. And there's a deeper message in here. It's that this is our conditioning. For example, I remember when this story was told to me by my parents, they also said, do you understand this insight? Whosever approval you seek, you are their prisoner. And there are quotations from the Quran that support that. Do you understand this, Jamal? So I, you know, like a koan, they would give it to me. I would meditate on that for days and weeks. Whosoever approval you seek, you are their prisoner. And I would say it's quite obvious. Of course it is. And they would understand that I don't quite comprehend that. And finally, when they felt that I had some inkling of what was being said, they gave me the answer. Choose your jailers with care and deliberation. But that's something we forget. And I'm always seeking approval from others.
We're at 1-877-GLOBE-07, 1-877-456-2307. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to another in our Inside Islam series. This one is about Sufism and the teaching tales of Mullah Nasruddin. We have a Facebook message from Diane, who writes, "I love Nasruddin, the holy fool, one of my favorites. Love the story of him losing his keys and looking under the street lamp." Yes. A guy says, "Oh, did you lose your keys here?" And Nasruddin says, "No, in my house." So the guy says, "Why then are you looking here in the street?" And what does Nasruddin reply? Jamal?
Oh, he says, I didn't lose it here. I lost over in my house. Then they say, why are you looking for it over here? He said, well, because there is no light over in my house. There's so much light over here. And of course, they all laugh. Then Mullah Nasruddin, he retorts with that now, that great spiritual message. Now he says, you tell me, when you have lost your joy, your peace of mind, your happiness, because of a failed relationship out there, and you spend all your time trying to fix this and fix that, blame this, blame that, did you lose it out there? Or did you lose it inside here? Pointing to the chest inside, you lose it inside you. But of course, it's much more inconvenient to look for it inside you. It's much more dim. And you spend all your time looking on the outside. But that's not where you lost it. That in Islam is called Qibla. Qibla means looking for things in the right direction. You see, it's so much more inconvenient to do that.
And here's a story about inconvenient truth. I mean, this preceded Al Gore. The inconvenience of truth. Does that ring a bell, or did I pull that out of thin air?
Oh, you mean is a story that goes with inconvenient truth?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't have that in my book. Are you referring to that, actually? Something in the book? I don't remember that then.
Well,
but I can tell you a story. I can tell you a story about inconvenient truth.
Okay, tell us.
You know, it's a very famous story of the mullah he's having a big party. He needs a huge pot. He goes over to his neighbor's house, and the housewife is reluctant to give him the pot. But, you know, she wants to be a good neighbor. She gives him the large pot. And the next day, the mullah returns, and he brings with him two pots. She says, "What's this?" And the mullah says, "Madam, didn't you know? Your pot was pregnant. It gave birth to this little pot." And she quickly thinks, says, yeah, I kind of thought so. But thank you so much. Thank you so much for having taken care of the delivery." And she takes those two pots. Next month, the mullah comes again to borrow the large pot. This time, she's very excited and happy to give it to him. But he doesn't come back. Second day, third day, fourth day, several weeks pass. Then she goes to his house and knocks on his door. "Where's my pot?" She says, "Madam, didn't you know your pot was pregnant? It died in childbirth." And she says, "How can a pot be pregnant?" He says, "You believed it the first time." And that is a lesson about how we adhere ourselves to certain truths for the sake of convenience. And then we get caught up in that ourselves.
I love this. This is fun. It's intriguing. And very lighthearted. We're talking about the tales of Mullah Nasruddin, a great Sufi teacher who is said to have lived in 13th century Turkey. Some people say there was never any such person. But somehow these tales have survived many centuries and show up in many different versions all over the East. They show up on YouTube as well. We'll hear another one that we found on YouTube right after this break. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Inside Islam on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm so glad Diane has heard of Nasruddin. I wonder if there are others who are listening who know about the mullah. We heard about him from someone who listens to our show in Turkey, who's been begging us for over a year now to do a program about Mullah Nasruddin. So we finally found the right master, the Sufi master, to tell the stories, and he is Jamal Rahman. I'm Jean Faraca. We're at 1-877-GLOBE-07. Do you know about this tradition of Sufism? Very deep in Islam. Some people say it even predates the religion itself. Are you surprised to learn that there is a teaching tradition that relies on humor in Islam? Why has this tradition gone underground? And isn't it time to bring it forth? Don't we need to soften the heart of Islam all over again? 1-877-GLOBE-07, 1-877-456-2307. Our email address is hereonearth@wpr.org. You can leave us a message on Facebook or Twitter. You'll find us under Here on Earth Show. You can also leave a message for us on our website, insideislam.wisc.edu. I'm Jean Faraca. Join in the conversation at the Here on Earth fan page on Facebook. There you'll find more video, more pictures, more talk, and more content on today's show. Go to Facebook.com, search for Here on Earth Show, and click like. Or you'll find a link at our homepage, hereonearth.org. It's social media without borders.
Support for WPR comes from Epic and Madison, giving patients online access to their health information through their web-based MyChart software. More information and career opportunities at epic.com.
Nasruddin, you're sophisticated, suave, elegant, and handsome. How is it you haven't married? Well, Amal, I've been looking for the perfect woman. You mean you've never found her? Well, I got close a few times, but there was always something lacking. Except one time I did find the perfect woman. She was tall, she was lithe, she was beautiful, she was intelligent, she was compassionate, she had everything a man could want. Nasruddin, why is it you never married her? Alas, she was looking for the perfect man.
That's San Francisco-based storyteller Irving Rothstein sharing a Mullah Nasruddin story in a YouTube video. We are focusing on the tradition of teaching Islam through humor this hour on Inside Islam. And we're zeroing in especially on the tales of Mullah Nasruddin. As we've been hearing, he shows up in oh so many places.
Yes.
I'm actually not at all surprised that this Jewish humorist has picked up on Nasruddin, because that does sound like a Jewish joke to me. Again, yes. Jamal, what is it about these stories that seem to defy cultural categories, that fly all over the place?
I think they touch the soul. They touch something very, very deep in us. I would say it's about an inner awareness of the paradoxes of life. And it is these stories that in very poor societies, and you know, the Muslims, if you take today's statistics, are among the poorest of the poor. And it is, I think, this humor that has really kept them, I don't want to say alive, but given them more hope, more enthusiasm, a deeper understanding of the way things really are. So it touches something very deep in the soul. And I think it's about an inner awareness.
Doesn't it also have to do with human nature?
Tell me more. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm thinking about the famous cheese sandwich story.
Ah, yes.
Which certainly got altered over the years, because I can't imagine a Sufi mystic from the 13th century eating a cheese sandwich.
Absolutely. It depends on which country they're in. It could be, noodles. It could be rice and curry. But I love that story. And I think you pointed to something very critical. The mullah loves to talk about the human ego. And this really goes back to verses in the Quran. In the Quran, it says that the human being is fitra, which means essentially noble. God has molded us in the best of forms, put the breath of God inside us. So each one of us is gifted with divine breath. But then God humorously says, I've also, out of a divine design, placed the slinking whisperer in every heart. So there's this constant tension leads to tragedy as also to comedy. So this cheese sandwich story is, I think, a very good story. It sort of points to the dilemma we are in. May I tell that story?
Please.
You know, the mullah, he goes to work, opens his lunch pail box, he finds a cheese sandwich. But second day, third day, fourth day, fifth, it's always a lousy cheese sandwich. 10th day, he opens his lunch pail box and he says, I'm getting sick and tired of this lousy cheese sandwich. His puzzled co-worker says, mullah, why don't you ask your wife to make you another kind of sandwich? Be persuasive with her. I'm not married. Who makes them? I do. So this sort of self-witnessing is essential in our lives. Again, it goes back to Prophet Muhammad, who said, know thyself and you shall know thy sustainer. Mm-hmm. Die before you die. Die to your ego before you die a physical death. And this is the most inconvenient work, becoming aware of ourselves. So the mullah, through humorous stories, he's trying to convince us of the great need to look at ourselves and to laugh at ourselves and to remind ourselves this simply is a reflection of that which is water and clay, as the Quran says, our personality, which is nothing more than a bundle of conditioned reactions to life's circumstances. That's not the real you. The real you is the breath of God inside of you.
We have Tan Zen, who joins us from, of all places, Rock.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Salam.
Shalom.
Salam, Tan Zen. Shalom, shalom.
Hi. Is it true you don't have to be a Muslim to be a Sufi? And do you think something about the story of the island by Nasruddin?
Well, first of all, the first part of your question, usually a Sufi is traditionally a Muslim also, but the word Muslim simply means one who is less attached to the ego, called the nafs in the Quran, so that one can bring a heart turned in devotion to God. So when Sufism has come to the West, because Sufism is so flexible, it doesn't matter what religion you are. So you have Christian Sufis, you have a lot of Jewish Sufis. In our part of the world, in India, you have Hindu Sufis. So yes, you don't have to be a Muslim in the true spiritual sense of being a Sufi. And the metaphor for that is, as the Sufis explain it, they say that a Muslim, when he or she prays, always points towards the Kaaba, the house of God, which is draped in black, in that direction. But then the question is, what happens if you are so advanced, so enlightened, that your prayer rug is actually inside the Kaaba? Then it doesn't matter which direction you point your prayer rug to. So in that sense, you can take the form of any religion. What was the second part of your question, Tan Zen?
Oh, about the story of the island.
Tell me about that. Is that a Rumi story? Or
I heard
a Rumi
that it
story?
Was a Nasruddin story called The Island.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that, Tan Zen.
Oh.
Are you familiar with it, Tan Zen?
No, my friend asked me about it, but I'm not.
Okay. Well, maybe someone who's listening will be able to enlighten us about Nasruddin's story about the island. Thank you for your call. We'll go to Mike next in Janesville. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I'm really happy that you guys are doing this type of thing. But it isn't really a question. It's just a comment. Long story short, back when I was growing up, something my dad always taught all of us kids. And come to find out when we got older and I worked with him for 15 years, I found out he had his own little bigotry, but that's neither here nor there. But what he had taught us was bigotry is born from ignorance. If you learn about the other people, listen to what they say, better chance that you will not be prejudiced against them. Only because you don't understand them is the reason people are prejudiced. And
Beautifully said. Basically
the main thing I wanted to say. I'm really happy you guys are doing this whole program.
Good. I'm glad you're enjoying it, Mike.
Yes.
And Mike's comment directs us to something that might come as a big surprise to many of us, and that is that Islam teaches respect for diversity.
Yes. And in fact, thank you so much for saying that, Jean, because I'm so eager to say that the Quran has an abundance of verses, and you can check for yourselves, that says that if Allah wanted, Allah could have made all of us one single community. But out of a divine design, out of infinite compassion, Allah chose to give us different languages, colors, religions, prophets, books, made us into nations and tribes, men and women, only for one reason, that you might get to know the other. So Mike, what you've said makes you a very good Muslim, Christian, Jew, whatever you are, a very good human being, and you have really tapped into the great secret and mystery of creating peace, which is really to get to know the other on a human level, heart-to-heart level.
1-877-GLOBE-07, that's the number to call to join the conversation. We're talking with Jamal Rahman about the great Sufi wise fool, Islam's holy fool, Mullah Nasruddin. Many, many tales show up in many, many different parts of the world from the 13th century onward. And we are learning about the mullah and how entertaining he is. These stories, in a way, remind me of another body of folklore, the stories about the trickster coyote that come to us from North American, Native American folklore. And others have compared them with Zen koans.
Right.
It's a counterintuitive wisdom that comes through. Like in the story you told earlier about looking for your key in all the wrong places.
Yes. Absolutely. So really it is a koan where if you allow yourself to meditate on that and go deeper with it, then one realizes that there are many levels of understanding about every verse, about every story, and that is a reflection of my consciousness. You know, that wonderful saying, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. So as we deepen, as we develop, we understand, we connect with deeper levels.
One of my favorite stories is the one that appears in the chapter in your book, Two Veils. It's about health and wealth.
Yes.
Which, as you put it, actually are obstacles to the development of spiritual understandings of wisdom.
Yes.
And in this case, the mullah shows up as a ferry captain.
Yes.
I'll read it. The mullah, a ferry captain, was privileged to have on board some learned and wealthy dignitaries, scholars, lawyers, and business people. To pass the time, they engaged the mullah in conversation and egged him to talk about his favorite topics. They amused themselves watching the mullah become animated as he talked of God, invisible realms, and the need to polish the heart so that one is in a fitting state to come into the presence of the beloved. Some in the group chuckled softly. These were people of science with little use for speculations and superstitions. Presently, a storm arose. It grew worse. The boat began to toss and turn helplessly. All was lost, it appeared. Amazingly, many among the people of reason got on their knees, imploring and pleading with God to save their lives. Promise after promise was offered, the kind of promises people make when desperate. The mullah, calm and poised, walked between them and advised, Friends, now, steady, don't be reckless with your goods. Now, I love that story, partly because I'm surrounded by scientists in my life,
many
of whom are extremely skeptical of religion, which they lump into the category of superstition.
Right.
What's the meaning of that story to you?
The meaning is that, you know, Islam means surrender. But of course, we are very reluctant to surrender unless something happens to us. The two veils that come in the way of us being seekers, the veil of health and wealth. When health is good, wealth is good. Wealth meaning not only money, but also emotional security. All this talk about God and spiritual practices is very inconvenient and distant. But should one break, shatter, I get cancer, my loved one gets cancer, divorce, or you lose your money in the stock market or your emotional security, then suddenly deeper questions. Why is this happening? I need help. And here's a key question that comes up. I need help from a source higher than human personality or human institutions. And that begins the process of a spiritual path which leads to surrender. Mm. That is why this is a key story in Islamic spirituality.
We have a caller who joins us from Duluth, Minnesota. Al? Hi, Al.
Hey, how you doing?
Go ahead. Well, we're short on time, so we...
Okay, I teach a course in humor literature, and I have my students read the Mullah stories online. There's quite a few links. I love the story where he's coming home and telling his wife that he has friends coming for dinner, and she says, oh, no, you don't. And he goes, well, then I'll go hide upstairs. Don't tell them I'm not here. He says, well, the mullah's not here. And I go, what do you mean? We just saw him walk through the front door. And he goes from the upstairs, how do you know I didn't leave from the back door? I love that story because it, you know, illustrates the way people can be very logical and wrong, and it attacks, you know, reason. But I have one more story. The professor, I had a bunch of friends that I asked to read the stories and tell me which were their favorites. And the one professor, who I find to be wrong a lot about a lot of things, she said, none of these are funny. I like the kind of humor that Woody Allen has. And I go, well, Woody Allen's kind of a Sufi a lot of the time. You know, but she just insisted none of them were funny. I go, well, you're pretty good because there's about 1,000 of them. You're the only one that read them all. Anyway, I just found that funny. And my students, though, they loved quite a few of them, and they all had their favorites. So.
I love the idea of Woody Allen as a Sufi.
right.
Jamal, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. And Jean, you're a great storyteller, let me tell you.
I come from an old storytelling tradition myself.
It shows, yeah. And I thank you for that.
Well, I thank you. And the book is wonderful.
Thank you so much.
It's called The Fragrance of Faith, The Enlightened Heart of Islam by Jamal Rahman. And you'll find a link to Jamal when you visit our website, hereonearth.org. If you'd like to purchase a CD of today's program, call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 818K. Thanks to Joe Hartke, our technical producer, Kayla Torgerson, our webmaster, Saideh Jamshidi took your calls and produced today's program with the cooperation of the Division of International Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Jean Faraca. Thanks for listening.